Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. If you've traveled to England, I'm fairly confident you've dropped in on a castle or two. Maybe Highclere, where Downton Abbey was filmed, or Buckingham Palace. There's another palace in London called St. James. It was created by King Henry VIII. And if you know your Henry VIII lore, you know a lot happened between the time construction started and the time it finished. Not the least of which was the beheading of the queen for whom the besotted king built the castle. Well, the castle grounds are the home of our guest today, Vice Admiral Tony Johnston Burt, who spent 2 years in Norfolk at the NATO command. So pour a cup of tea, dip into your biscuits, and stay tuned for a royally good time after this news from NPR. Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. You probably know, or at least I hope you do, that NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, has its North American headquarters right here in Norfolk. It's called Supreme Allied Command Transformation. Representatives from all the NATO nations work at the headquarters on the grounds of Naval Base Norfolk, and they and their families live throughout the region. The chief of staff to the commander of ACT was Vice Admiral Tony Johnston Burt, and in the second year of his 3-year term, he got a call that changed his life. On the other end of the line was someone asking him to come home to meet with Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth to talk about a new job as the master of the household of the sovereign. The Vice Admiral took the next flight out, and after tea with the Queen, he got the job. The post was created in 1539, just 2 years after the completion of St. James Palace, where Vice Admiral Johnston Burt and his family now live. He welcomed us into the staterooms at the palace complex.
Thanks so much for having us over today. This is a magnificent setting here at St. James Palace.
Well, Kathy, it's wonderful to see you again, and we do miss Norfolk.
Do you?
Hugely. But yeah. We'll come to that. And, mm-hmm. But what I'd love to do is to tell you where we are and picture the creative picture for our listeners. We're sitting in the entree room in St. James's Palace in London, which is our home, not this entree room, it's too grand, but we live in an apartment here with my family. And we're living in a palace which is 900 years old. It was originally, the site was created in about 1100 as a hospital for lepers, maidens with leprosy, rather sadly. It was given by Henry VI to Eton College in 1450. As a way of developing the hospital and things like that. Then in Henry VIII decided he rather liked the look of the site and wanted to build a fifth palace.
One does.
And this is in 1531. And we don't know quite why he wanted to build a fifth palace. The theory is, one of the theories is it was for Anne Boleyn. But actually, as we all know from our history, she didn't last very long.
Did not go well.
And what is wonderful is in the tapestry room, there's a wonderful fireplace where they obviously were building the palace. And on the left-hand side, top left-hand, there's a wonderful motif with a rose and H intertwined with A, obviously when it was established. And then by the time it got to the far top right-hand corner, it's just H because poor Anne had her head chopped off in 1536. So people didn't last long. But yeah. Anyway,
this is sort of the anatomy of a relationship gone bad, all in the fireplace mantle.
Yes,
there.
Absolutely. So 17 generations of the royal family have been living in this wonderful site over the last 900 years. And it's a beautiful place to be. It's a huge privilege to be part of that. And we're sitting in the entree room. The throne room is just ahead of us. The Queen Anne room is behind us. It's rich in gold and red wall coverings. But I love this room best because there are four wonderful admirals looking down at us, created by Joshua Reynolds and Hoppner, and particularly Nelson, who's my hero.
It's a fantastic room. It's a fantastic place to be. And as you point out, so rich in history. Now today, what is St. James Palace used for primarily?
What we use the state apartments where we're sitting in now for entertaining for Her Majesty and members of the royal family. That's the main role of it. It is also a place where it houses two chapels royal, the Chapel Royal and the Queen's Chapel. And we have, they are for all ceremonial, you know, for all services that, that Her Majesty requires here. And we have a canon who's an incumbent here, who's called the sub-dean. Mm-hmm. And the dean is the Bishop of London. So Richard Charteris. So again, there's a very special relationship there. But this used to be the place for all members of the royal family as a sort of holding position if they were in going to be the heir presumptive. Uh-huh. and senior members of the royal household.
I see.
Now it houses seven members of the royal family, and we've got very good security as a result. But only two families. One's my family, mm-hmm. The other is the family of the canon.
I see.
He's got a little son, yeah. Who's about five.
And so the Chapel Royal was, if I'm remembering this correctly, was where Prince George was christened. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So this is a very close proximity. Your home is to that.
Exactly.
To the chapel.
Exactly. And it's also used as offices principally for the Prince of Wales, Prince Charles, because Clarence House is where he lives, mm-hmm. With the Duchess of Cornwall. Mm-hmm. And the Prince's Trust is a huge charity, hugely successful.
Yeah.
And a lot of his staff occupy the office spaces around here. But the staterooms themselves are used all year round to enable the Queen, the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince of Wales, and other members of the royal family to entertain and give opportunities for their charities to demonstrate their work and encourage and to thank donors and sponsors for that work. So huge range.
How did you come to be here? Because I think most people hear Vice Admiral Tony Johnston Burt. And that's obviously a distinguished naval career. How do you come to this place?
Kathy, I was having a fabulous time in Norfolk, but I got through the post an email saying, would I like to apply to be the Master of the Royal Household? And I thought, what? What's that? I'd never heard of the Master, and I'd never been a courtier before. Yeah. And I thought, do I do that? I'm a warrior. I do operations. I do Afghanistan, Iraq. I don't do flunkying around.
Yeah.
And Rachel said, well, you know, why don't you just have a look? This is a great compliment.
So, Rachel's your wife, yeah?
Yeah. So I threw my hat in the ring, thinking I had nothing to lose. And I was stunned to go through the interview process and be asked for an interview by the Queen. And I went, oh, my God. Goodness.
Kind of an email that floats to the top of the box, doesn't it?
Yes. And I was completely surprised, and the Queen was fabulous. I felt it was rather surreal because I'd only really seen her on a stamp.
So I was wondering, what's that like?
And wonderful, and she was charming and kind and put me at my ease immediately. And she said, now you haven't been part of my organization before, because all my predecessors, I'm her ninth master, and quickly as an aside, it was established in 1603, so it's over 400 years old, this position, by James I after the last Queen Elizabeth, and I'll talk about the job in a minute, mm-hmm. But the Queen said, you obviously, you know, haven't been here, because all my predecessors had been an equerry, an aide to the Queen, or served in the Royal Yacht, or in a Guards regiment that the Queen had been involved in. And I said, so clearly you're going to have a lot to learn.
You think?
I said, well, Your Majesty, that won't change a habit of a lifetime.
Yeah, okay.
I've always had loads to learn.
That's a great answer.
And so it's wonderful. So it's a huge privilege. So with huge sadness, I left Norfolk. We had a fabulous time. The warmth, the friendliness, the kindness that we had. It was a wrench because we left effectively. I left the Navy a year early, or left that job a year early.
Oh, right.
The job, you know, there was potentially another job, mm-hmm. or two, or maybe promotion. They were sort of waving that seductively in front of me.
But how many times do you get the opportunity to do something like this?
It's a one-off. And so I jumped.
And so your position in Norfolk, because I think a lot of people don't necessarily fully understand the role of NATO in Norfolk.
Yes.
That's the American headquarters for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Yes. There are two strategic commands in NATO. One is based in Belgium, somewhere called Mons, and that deals with all operations. So, and it's always commanded by an American senior officer, airman, sailor, or soldier. And it's now it was General Breedlove. I think they're just about to change. It was Admiral Stavridis before Breedlove. That is a pivotal position, and they were responsible for running the wars in. For NATO in Iraq and Afghanistan. So that's hugely important. The French, one of the conditions that the French negotiated was that if they were to return for the in the military side of NATO, they would like one of those senior positions, one of the two. The Americans clearly said, no, thank you. No, this is ours. But, you know, what about the rest? So the NATO alliance said, yes, you can have the other one. And that's based in Norfolk, Virginia. And that's called Allied Command Transformation.
And what ACT, Allied Command Transformation, what is the... It's really a future-looking role, isn't it?
It has a number of roles. It's responsible for all the training for operations, whereas ACO, one in Mons, Allied Command Operations, does the delivery. So all training for operations, all concept and capability development. Mm. So what kit do we need? What does the future look like? Do we need heavy armor or light armor?
Yeah.
You know, are we light footprint logistically, in, out, quickly, finish, gone? Or is it a long, should we prepare for a long sustained campaign? And what is it, and we won't go political, but what is very interesting is since I left, tensions in the Middle East and with our Russian neighbours, that again has changed the dynamic and made this even more important. So capability development, concept development, strategic thinking, and training for operations.
And so all of this prepared you wonderfully well for operating palaces.
It did. Well, exactly, Kathy. I said to myself, well, it can't be that different. It must be similar. And I couldn't be more wrong.
Yeah.
It's completely different. My job... Yeah, it's similar in a way, but I convinced myself, and I don't know why I thought it would be. I think it was probably because I wanted to reassure myself that it wouldn't be too much of a change. It was completely different, and the what was most interesting. I'm called the Master of the Royal Household, and what does that mean? That means I'm really the Chief Operations Officer. I deliver the program for the Queen. There are five heads of department. Everybody, the Queen likes us all to stay in lane. And if you don't, if you stray, she says, Master, she calls me Master. That's not your job, that's his job.
So she is very actively engaged in keeping you in your own.
We have direct access to her.
Wow.
And we have a chairman of the committee called the Lord Chamberlain, and he is a sort of the titular head. But the Queen insists on us all reporting to her individually. So I don't think things has changed for 500, 600 years.
That's amazing.
So I deliver the program for the Queen. I have a staff of about 330. They are all. Everything that happens in the palaces, because I'm responsible for all the palaces, it cannot happen without my team. From the moment somebody steps into Buckingham Palace, St James's Palace, Windsor Castle, the Palace of Holyrood House up in Edinburgh, Balmoral, Sandringham, that they all will meet my staff first. And any meetings that it's rather like my team are rather like the oil in the engine. It's the engine room or the heart and the bloodstream. They enable everything that happens, whether it's a meeting or a meals or a state banquet or a reception. It's my team. If you want things moved around, I've got a heavy gang. I've got people who clean, but in a conservation way to make sure that the gold, you know, the silver gilt, all the gold you see is properly looked after. They clean not with a duster and a feather thing.
Yeah.
They clean with paintbrushes, very fine brushes, to make sure we don't damage the objet d'art.
Wow.
So it's a fabulous job. And my team are made up of really young, energetic, enthusiastic people who are massively dynamic. So, and we have a mantra. I created a mantra for them, which is one team, one standard.
That's wonderful.
And that is team excellence through teamwork.
Yeah.
So that is that there is only one standard, and that is the best. There's no silver or bronze. It's all gold. And what I love about them is that they're massively enthusiastic, and they, my objective from a leadership perspective is to release their potential and enable them to fly, because I've noticed in my military career that if you there's no limit on morale. You know, morale, I imagine, like a big dustbin with a lid on, and, and a captain at sea can really crush that morale by forcing that lid on. I've always lifted the lid so it's a sort of big shaft of light that emitting from that bin. And so they're a really happy crew. So in terms of what's similar and what's different, the people are the same because they're young, enthusiastic, bright graduates doing all sorts of different things. That's the same. And so there's, in terms of leadership, that is, you know, you're there to motivate and inspire and give people opportunities. What's different is the way in which people don't respond in the same way. You need to, we're in the military, people, I always used to encourage people to challenge me, but an awful lot of people don't. And there's a sort of expectation that if you ask somebody to do it and do it, ask them nicely in the military, it'll be done.
Sure. And you have these stars and bars things on your shoulders that sort of inspire that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas in real life, and this is maybe not real life.
I was going to say, this might not be real life, no. But I take your point.
But in dealing with civilians, I've learned that actually that's not always the case. And the little story I'll tell you is that when I arrived, I had to write a paper. I wanted a paper. And in Norfolk, I had 11 people working for me personally. I had a German general. I had an American US Navy captain. I had a Dutch colonel and a whole raft of staff, and a nice lieutenant, US Navy lieutenant aviator, who is my ADC. And you'd say, you give them an idea, and then they produce a brief for you. Like that, bang.
Done.
And then you say, good, thank you very much, Dean. And you sort of tweak it a bit, and boof, off it went. Lovely. I thought, yes, I need to write a paper. I'll ask one of my team, could you possibly write a paper? This is sort of guidelines, da-da-da. Yes, of course. 2 weeks later, nothing. And I said, so how are you getting on? Sorry. No, I haven't started.
Really? Why?
Oh, I've been very busy, you know.
Busy.
I thought, no, you can't say that.
That
so I said, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I see. So that's the rule. They're the rules now.
Thank you very much.
So thank you very much. Well, I better do it myself then, I thought to myself. So I did. So you can't always assume people will jump and salute smartly, turn right and carry on.
Yeah. I think that's a big lesson, too. Yeah. It's a very interesting one because we have, as you know, in Norfolk, a lot of military people retire there, and that's a wonderful thing. But there is this leadership transition and this sort of switch to civilian life that some find very challenging.
Yes. And what's fascinating, watching my friends across all three services, because I did an awful lot of joint jobs, I think we can, in the military, get rather seduced by academic qualifications and certainly status in terms of rank. And you notice that with the keenness of people to remind you that they went to Oxford, Cambridge, Yale or Harvard.
Yes.
And all their other wonderful universities. And secondly, the use of their rank. Some they can't let go of. And the Queen wants me to keep my rank here, but which is rather a nice treat. But I don't expect it.
Yeah.
I realized in the civilian world, actually, it's more about what you do and what you say, and it is a far more level playing field. And some of my colleagues actually haven't been able to be so successful in the civilian world and the business world as they were. Obviously, in the military world,
right.
So it's a very interesting. It's more of a level playing field, and the people who possibly didn't reach such high ranks, suddenly you find being the chief executive of this huge multinational, you think, crikey. So yeah. Did we miss a trick in the military? You know, what has this guy or this woman got that we missed?
That we missed, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's a combination of issues. I think it is seductive, the chain of command and obedience can make people lazy and assume that they're right. You know, because the more senior I also noticed that I was getting funnier. People were laughing at my jokes the more senior.
You were just more hilarious as you went along.
Exactly. Yeah. As I got more senior, I was even funnier. And I thought, what? Am I really? And I was getting cleverer.
I should be opening a comedy club. I'm so funny. Right.
Yeah. And I was getting cleverer as well. Yeah. People say, you're so clever. I thought, really? But they don't do that in the civilian world.
Isn't that something?
It's truthful. But the other thing, Kathy, is... I think it's about the people who really succeed, and leadership is all about emotional intelligence,
yeah.
EQ, and that enables, and it's not just enabling one's own self-awareness to be acute and understanding oneself, it's also understanding other people and being able to put yourself in other people's circumstances and positions. And that goes from an international perspective strategically, trying to understand why the Russians are behaving, for example, the way they are, right through to personal relationships,
right,
in the workplace. And I don't think the royal household is any different from that.
Sure.
So masses of EQ is essential. And part of that is humility.
Mm.
And being... willing to not be proud and being listening more than transmitting,
yeah.
Being able to admit one's wrong and take people's ideas and avoid the not invented here syndrome. And Nelson, who's standing just, you know, right above your head, it epitomized that.
Yeah.
You know, he was deeply flawed as a character, and had a mistress, as we all know, and, you know, behaved badly, but actually he did have humility.
Ah.
And he was immensely brave, and he connected with people in the way that in his generation his peers would just you know, this was strange.
It seems to me that's sort of the enduring longing when you work,
yes,
in a team or in an organization. You really want to be heard,
yeah.
You want to do work that matters,
yes,
and you want your life,
yes,
to have meaning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And making feel you are doing something worthwhile that makes a difference.
Yeah.
And the young people I have working for me all want to make a difference.
And I know one of the things you are working on, I think as a lot of American organizations are as well, is expanding the team of people and,
yeah,
the characteristics of the team of people,
yeah,
making it much more reflective of the diversity of,
yeah,
it was certainly,
yeah,
what,
yeah,
here in London is a very diverse culture.
Yeah, yeah. What one of this of, again, the issues that I've introduced to my team is that for particularly this institution, it's got to be relevant. The monarchy has to be relevant,
mm-hmm,
to continue to exist. It must be representative of Britain, and it's also we must retain the respect for the monarchy. So those three R's are my sort of personal strategy. Her Majesty hasn't asked me for these, but I can't help it because I'm like that. So that's what I passed on to my,
yeah,
team. And key element is the one you've just mentioned, which is we must be representative. And one of my duties, extra duties, as it were, which is pan-household, is diversity and inclusion. And so because it's very crystal clear to me that more diverse a community you've got, the greater talent you can tap into. You avoid all sorts of errors in groupthink, mm-hmm, and all the rest of it by having people with different perspectives. And what's really interesting is, for us, it's all about... It's predominantly about women and black, Asian, and minority ethnic communities.
Which is a term here.
It's called BAME.
BAME.
Black, Asian, minority ethnic, BAME or, mm-hmm, BME.
Mm-hmm.
We've got over 50%, 51-52% of women in the, mm-hmm, royal household, which is great. But they're in the wrong place. They're not in the top half. They're majority, which is wrong, absolutely wrong. And I sit on a number of committees where I am in a minority, with the majority being women. For some of these meetings I have, and the dynamic is completely different. Mm. And I know, because I've having went to a boarding school at 8, all boys, and popping out at the end at 18, all boys, boarding school, and then going to university, short stop with, you know, women there. Gosh, hello, and then into the Navy, all men,
yeah.
And then suddenly I don't see a woman serving at sea with me until I'm commanding my first frigate, and. Crikey, you know, they're really good. And my best officer of the watch was a woman. Mm. And my worst, most troublesome sailor was a woman. And all I had was, you know, a complete spectrum.
Yeah.
But I thought, why is this my best officer of the watch? You know, what is it about her that is so good? And it's because she was a really good, you know, efficient professional.
Yeah. Sure, right.
So shocking. Why am I surprised?
Yes, right.
And so I think there's a lot we can do. And so women is the first issue, and a different perspective, but also the Black, Asian and minority ethnic. And what I've done is I'm working very hard at building the percentage. It's not about numbers. Mm-hmm. It's about diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. We're very well represented in the LGBTI community, which is fantastic because again they bring a different dimension. It's not something that is, you know, worn on their sleeve,
right?
But it's just a fact of life,
right?
And everybody mixes in really, really well. It's tolerant, respect, tolerance and respect is everything.
Yeah.
And then you get the ideas once people are relaxed and roll. So I'm trying to up the percentage. And I made friends with the Lord Lieutenant of Greater London. He was the first Black Lord Lieutenant in Greater London in history. And the Lord's Lieutenant, the Queen nominates a man or a woman to be her representative in each county in Great Britain. You know, Wales, Northern Ireland, England. They represent her for medal ceremonies when required, or any other ceremonies, or arrange visits and escort her on visits when one of the members of the royal family visit that county. And this guy is called Ken Olisa, who's absolutely brilliant. And so I've bonded with him, and we're working on how we can introduce and raise awareness and understanding what the royal household is within London. Because most people see this rather stark, beautiful, but forbidding facade of Buckingham Palace and go, gosh, you know, what goes on in there? And nobody has any idea.
Who gets in there? How do
exactly,
you do that?
How do you get in there? And what do you need in there?
Yeah.
And they're 40% of the adult working population, 40% are Black, Asian, minority ethnic people in London.
In London.
In
wow.
London. 14% is across the a nation, and we're about 6.5-7% in the household.
Yeah.
So we're going up. The curve is going up, but it's slow.
Yeah.
In the royal household, it's like a little village, because you name a profession, we've got it. We've got doctors, nurses, we've got people, grooms, we've got people ride, you know, the carriages and the horses and do all that business. We've got plumbers, electricians, architects. We've got footmen who do the front of house, the valeting, and we've got chefs. We've got a publication section. We've got the Royal Collection, who do all the conservation of the art and restore all the pieces of objet d'art, as well as the china, etc., as well as the paintings. We've got accountants, we've got security people, we've got IT people, we've got telephonists, we've got people who understand finance, people who understand politics. We've got a secretariat who looks after the Queen. You name it, we've got it. So, you know, you can jump in there and find your niche.
Right.
Without
lots of opportunity.
Lots of opportunity.
Yeah.
So that's but diversity is absolutely key.
Yeah.
And we need to do better.
That's an amazing thing. And I wonder, diversity, it seems to me, is a key leadership skill too.
Yeah.
You know, enhancing and developing diversity and sort of leveraging all of those opportunities. And I've also been really intrigued by your leadership skills, but also by Her Majesty's leadership skills.
Yes.
And I wonder, because you've been leading people for a long time, but she's been leading people for a lot longer, what do you observe about her leadership skills?
Kathy, the Queen, and I thought about this hard, she is probably the greatest leader that I've ever worked for. And why? Because she commands, she seems to combine that authority, that very clear decision-making capability, with immense humility and thoughtfulness and kindness. In the military, sometimes people can mistake people being thoughtful, kind, as weak. People who are you know, underconfident, you know, you wouldn't believe it with some of our admirals and generals, but people who hide that compensate by being autocratic and think that being decisive and shouty is a good way of leading. No, and the Queen is immensely thoughtful. She is very, very kind, but she's also tough. And very, very capable and willing to take tough decisions. But on the other hand, you know, understands, has immense compassion. So she is absolutely wonderful, with huge humility as well. You know, always very self-deprecating. And you think, crikey, you know, almost as if she doesn't quite believe that who she is.
Right.
So I have a huge respect for her. But from a political perspective, this actually, all those qualities have been brilliant, because constitutionally she has the right to be consulted and advise. That's it. Finish. When she sees the Prime Minister every week, once a week, in the evenings, and it's just her and the Prime Minister, and whatever goes on in behind those closed doors, we never hear. Neither refers to it, and it's inappropriate to ask. But in that time, you know, I'd be amazed if she didn't do quite a lot of advising.
Yeah.
But we never know.
I think that's so interesting too, because if you think about the succession of leaders that she's experienced over her reign, and now a new leader, Theresa May.
Exactly.
It's amazing.
But she also likes change. And what is staggering is, over her 64 years of being our queen, the way she's adapted. And so she's managed to pull off an extraordinary trick of creating a sense of continuity and stability for the country, which we all need, in a very tumultuous time, in the face of an exponential change and development in technology, as the same time as being able to adapt and bring her whole family with her in adapting to this new world. So at 90 now, she is of a generation of, you know, my parents. And I'm not sure if my parents could have adapted. Well, I knew they weren't. I mean, they've passed away now, but they could certainly not have adapted in the way that the Queen has adapted. And it's very easy to forget, because she's so vital and so with it and sharp and doesn't let you get away with the thing, that you forget that actually she is of that generation.
Yeah.
And so it's a wonderfully clever trick of being able to adapt to change, remain current, remain adaptable, flexible, and versatile, and yet still represent this continuity, stability, and reassurance for the nation. Because with all the political dramas that I know you've been watching in America, with all the rest of the things with Europe, she's like a steadying effect, you know, wonderfully reassuring influence on the nation.
You, I see you in the background in some pictures from time to time at various events at the different palaces. Well, we should note that you have how many palaces have charge of?
Seven.
Seven?
Yeah.
And they're all over the place.
You know, Edinburgh, the Palace of Holyrood House, Balmoral, which is a private house for the Queen. But my job is to support the sort of all the staff to deliver what she needs. Because the Queen, doesn't matter whether she's at Balmoral, which is private, and Sandringham, which is private, she continues to be the head of state. So the boxes.
So Balmoral is the summer place.
Exactly.
And then Sandringham is winter Christmas. Place,
Christmas. Yeah. And their family and friends visit both, members of the royal family, visit throughout her periods at those places. But business goes on. Mm. So she has, Her Majesty has her secretary with her up there all the time. I go up there twice in the summer, once down in at Christmas to see if there's anything that I can do to help. She's not happy about. Her boxes continue. So boxes of issues
of state.
This is the box of
the correspondence.
All her correspondence. Yeah. We all have boxes. So we all have our own box. and mine says Master of the Royal Household. And we have a little tally on it that when I send her a message, it's the Queen. And then she opens it with a special key.
Yeah.
And she squiggles and says, yes, no, you know, do better.
Let's talk about this.
And then she flips over the tally and it says, the Master.
That's
and it comes
amazing.
Back. Is that funny?
It is. And I wonder, do these palaces almost have their own personality? Because they're very...
Yes.
They're very different.
Yes, they all have different personalities. And roles. Buckingham Palace is the office, and that's the Queen is here from Monday to Friday, and then at weekends she goes to Windsor Castle, and that is home. Windsor is very special to her. She was there throughout the war, with her parents, Then Holyrood is a bit like Windsor Castle, but in Scotland. And we're there for a week in the summer, a royal week. We spend the whole of April at Windsor Castle. It's called Easter Court, where the court leaves Buckingham Palace, and we all take on station in, live in the castle for a month. And that's beautiful and fabulous, and another completely different change of scene. And then, as you've mentioned, at the end of July, the Queen goes off with a huge spring in her step to Scotland, which she absolutely adores, to Balmoral, and stays there throughout the summer until early October, and then comes back.
Yeah.
And we have the Christmas term, as it were, and then Sandringham for Christmas.
So varying levels of formal, I mean, I'm sure it's all formal, but
yes.
Varying levels of formal throughout.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And different degrees of inclusion of the royal household in terms of meals and events.
So does this mean that in some cases you have meals with the royal family?
At Windsor and at Balmoral and Sandringham, but not at Buckingham Palace, which is wonderful.
So may I ask, I can't even imagine what that would be like to have a meal, your first time, having never seen her except on a postage stamp.
Yes.
You get this job. What's the first meal that you have with her?
We had I think it was lunch. I had a very strict mother.
So you
who drilled me very carefully.
Yeah. So you knew which of the nice forks to use.
And I knew not to dribble.
A little bit intimidating.
And eat with my mouth closed.
Yeah. Oh, all those are good things. Those are very good things.
And
but that must have been intimidating at some level.
No, she was so relaxed.
Really?
And so nice and normal that it was extraordinarily not, relaxing.
It's amazing.
A wonderful, relaxed setting.
Yeah.
And great company.
You talked about assuring that the monarchy remains relevant.
Yes.
I'm guessing that's on her mind as well, because she's been very adaptable as times have changed.
Yes. And I think they're all the royal family are aware of that. And I think Prince Charles is acutely concerned with the environment, as you know, and politics.
Right.
And there's an extraordinary range of interests he's got, and an extraordinarily successful charities that he runs under the aegis of the Prince's Trust, in terms of helping young people right through to sorting out the environment. And so And that couldn't be more relevant, really, having that interest. He's concerned about climate change, as you may know. All the other members are all family the same. So Prince Andrew is concerned. He's seized with trying to help entrepreneurs, yeah. young people develop and have opportunities and technology. The Earl and Countess of Wessex are doing exactly the same thing, particularly with young people. The Princess Royal never stops working across a whole raft. They've all got about 100, 150 charities that they're wow. patrons of, mm-hmm. and they support those every day. And that's just the sort of the nuclear, you know, royal family. The Duke of Edinburgh just doesn't stop. He is just like an extraordinary man, yeah. hugely bright, inquisitive. He reads voraciously.
And I'm told and he's not tremendous. A fan of small talk, that he really likes meaningful conversation.
Exactly. Yeah. No, he likes a joke. He's yeah. always joking. Oh. but he also is an extraordinary reader.
Yeah.
And will read anything and would love to discuss it. And the cousins, you know, the Duke of Kent, the Duke and Duchess of Gloucester, and the Princess Alexandra and the Prince Michael and Princess Michael of Kent, they're all very busy doing charitable mm. things, and also Princess Eugenie and Princess yeah. Beatrice, who the Duke of York's daughters, and on and on. So there's a great commitment and, mm. and focus on delivering. The Duchess of Cornwall and, of course, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, Prince William and Princess Catherine, they're all really good. Prince Harry, you yeah. know, they're all really committed. So the Cambridges and Prince Harry are obviously very committed to mental health. Mm. Prince Harry, particularly with our Wounded Warriors.
He's really done some amazing work in that.
Been a fantastic yeah. success. Yeah. And he's a great champion. So I think this is all, in terms of relevance, this is good news.
Absolutely.
But it's, you know, it's something that's, it's hard won and easily lost. And I think that they're very aware of that, that there is a responsibility there, that they continue doing that.
As much as that responsibility weighs, there have to be lighter moments as well. I was watching a documentary and it had a scene in it that I've never seen Her Majesty like this, but it was a scene from maybe 30, 40 years ago, and it was a horse race.
Yes.
And her face got so animated, and she ran around the corner, and I thought, wow, you yeah. know, that's just not something we would typically see. No. Horses are obviously enormously
a real passion. And at Ascot this year,
yeah.
Prince Charles had a horse running in one of the races, and he was totally smitten, and not having had
yeah.
A horse running at Ascot before. And I'm new to horses, being a sailor.
not many of those on the sea, I take it. Mm-hmm.
So I said to her, because he's got two horses, and I said, so having both horses competing, I said, you know, what's that like? And this expert said, look, Tony, it's like having only two children, both of whom went to Harvard or Yale or one of the top universities in America, and both being in the Olympics.
That's a gift of perspective.
That's what it. And I went, oh, I see.
Okay, all righty then.
He absolutely loved it. Yeah. His horse, unfortunately, came in fifth or something, okay. but very respectful.
Yeah.
But he is now really keen on horses.
That's funny. Yeah.
But he's always ridden himself as well.
And does Her Majesty have? I'm told that she has a great sense of humor, and I know you've
wonderful. Yeah.
seen some moments yes, yes, of that. Because yes. I think so many of the times that we see her, it's in an official sort of state capacity.
Yes, serious face.
So maybe yeah. that we don't yeah. get to see that yeah. as much.
No, but a huge sense of humor, mm-hmm. and all the royal family are great mimics. So
really,
they're terribly funny, and they love all of them have a wonderful sense of the ridiculous. So you know, anything that's just silly, they hate pomposity uh-huh. of people who stand on ceremony.
Yeah.
They're very quick to puncture somebody who's being pompous.
Okay. And they have sort of a radar for that.
Yes.
That's amazing.
So huge fun.
Yeah.
Huge fun.
So it's been a good move.
Wonderful move. I adore the Navy. Mm-hmm. I spent a long time on operations and with the Army and the Royal Air Force. I love the American services. Absolutely adore them. My time. I've got some such close friends now in America. But I'm not looking back. And somebody said to me, well, if you did go back, what would it be? And I said, well, it would either be commanding all NATO forces on operations.
No small dreams.
Or commanding an aircraft carrier again.
Yeah.
And I don't think they'd let me do either. Cause I think I'd probably be dangerous.
but move all the way around. And
very happy family. I was in the Navy for 37 years. And I change jobs every two. You can hear the band.
I was just going to say, I'm picking up some sound outside.
That is the band that is taking station for the changing of the guard.
Okay.
At Buckingham Palace. They're based here. They set off here, then they march.
Yeah. I think I said this to you last night, but we have a Christmas ornament that is one of the palace guards.
Yes.
And when I looked out the window and saw that, I thought, this is like a little Christmas ornament coming to life. I mean, it's the most unbelievable thing. Yeah, but here we are, and so I don't know if you can hear that, but there's drums and
pipes
and all kinds of things happening outside. Yeah, so and that's pretty. That's sort of the clock
routine
by which you you live your life here.
Yeah, there's a changing of guard. It happens at 12.
Yeah,
and they should be on station. It's now 11:15. They'll be on station at 11:30.
Fantastic.
11, and they'll be parading right through to 12:00. So
that's
there'll be
wonderful
crowds outside Buckingham Palace now, which is hundreds deep. All around the Queen Victoria Monument, which has got the a beautiful gold statue on top, because the Statue of Liberty.
It's amazing. You know, the thing about the friendship between these two countries, I remember back to 9/11, which of course I think anybody who is alive at that moment does, and that day was so surreal. That day was so completely surreal. And I can remember sitting up 3:00 in the morning, our time, just watching it over and over, trying to just wrap your head around this horror that had just happened, and thinking, I shouldn't be emotional about this, and yet just so shocked. And it wasn't until they showed outside of Buckingham Palace, they played the national anthem.
Yes.
And for some reason, that opened the floodgates.
Yeah.
I don't know why, because I think there's that, that sense of connection.
Yes.
Shared history.
Yeah.
That continues, and I don't know. It was just a moment.
It is. There's such a close affinity between our nations, and we mustn't let anything ever get in the way. I'll show you later. But the Queen Victoria Memorial monument is one element of a whole tribute to Queen Victoria, which is the whole of the Mall, going down to Admiralty Arch at the other end, and all the gates from the Commonwealth, and on top of this gold statue at the top is called Winged Victory. And it is absolutely beautiful, and that is also it reminds me of America as well, because that shows you how inextricably connected we are.
Absolutely. Anything you miss about Hampton Roads? Can we send you a jar of Dumars cones? Anything?
I love Dumars. I miss the people. I miss their smiling, welcoming approach. Nothing was too difficult for us. We were embraced like brothers and sisters in a way that I'd never noticed in any other country. And the Virginia peanuts.
Oh, fair enough. That's a delicacy the world over, isn't it?
That's the two things.
That's wonderful. Well, but thank you so much for spending this time with us. It has been so delightful, and I'm very grateful.
Well, it's been wonderful talking, and let's do this again, and I'll give you another
let's
update.
Let's do it.
And
let's do it again. I like that idea. Thank We're you. Back in a moment.
Okay, you're going to think I'm bragging, and maybe you're right, but I'm going to tell you anyway about one of the payoff nights in my life. Now, we don't get many payoff nights, or days for that matter, but I won an award the other day. Now, that is something that just doesn't happen to critics. When you think about it, critics are not the most liked, much less awarded people in the world. My life has been threatened. Anyway, I am the winner of the Vianweb Lifetime Achievement Award for critical writing in the Hampton Roads area. I may be overly proud, but I think now, when I die, they should write Alley Award winner after my name. You see, this award is presented by the Cultural Alliance of Greater Hampton Roads as the Alley Award, and believe me, it's not easy to win it. It took me 52 years, and still, it's questionable. But there I was at the Waterside Sheraton Hotel in downtown Norfolk. Dunner, coat and tie, the whole thing. Embarrassed to no end that some people would pass by the table and say, good luck. The Lifetime Achievement Award is toward the end of the evening, and that means that you eat and you sit for a few hours as you wonder. Okay, I thought. Yeah, I kind of think I deserve this award. After all, when I came here, the Virginia Symphony didn't even exist. It shared bookings with Richmond. And the Virginia Stage Company wasn't here, and the Virginia Opera wasn't here. And we've been through all of it. Promoting, writing, reviews are promotion, even if they're bad. Now, I've written about award shows for years, and I've often written about stars who made fools of themselves accepting awards. Now I'm getting my comeuppance. I thought of something to say. I'll say, it's taken me 50 years to get up those steps. But then I thought the steps looked shaky. Forget the steps. And then it happened. I won. Get up. Get up, Mal. I decided not to try the steps, but asked Bill Griggs, the MC, to pass me the microphone. I said something like, well, it would have been nice if you had given this to me when I was young and good-looking. And I think somebody said, when was that? When indeed. Anyway, I wanted to say something that I was not just a movie critic, that I edited a Sunday entertainment section in the Virginian Pilot for over 20 years. For over 20 years. In any case, I forgot to say that. I forgot it totally. I mostly thought about Vianweb, for whom this award is named. I knew her. She helped me. If it wasn't for Vianweb, the radio station that you're hearing this on would not be here, probably, and certainly it wouldn't be in this form. I remember her as a hard fighter for establishing two radio stations, one for news and one for classical music. And I'd like to thank Mae West, and I'd like to thank Lassie, and I'd like to thank Rachmaninoff and Beethoven. I wrote about all of you. It's been a lot of fun, but one lifetime is not enough. Now, I'm ready to win another Alley Award because next time I'll be ready. I know now that all you have to do is relax and just say thank you. So, thank you.
Thanks, Mal. I hope you enjoyed our royal conversation today. I think it was well worth the trip. I hope you agree. We'll see you right back here on Monday.